We've arrived at the difficult unit for most people. This, well, based on scores, seems to be the most difficult unit, which has to do with two major themes, metabolism and energy. And we'll start with there's three chapters. We'll start with an overview of metabolism and energy, and then the other two chapters are specific metabolic pathways. We'll have glycolysis and cellular respiration in the next chapter, and then photosynthesis to round out the unit. The opening slide is just a schematic representation of what is called a biochemical pathway. Now, speaking of metabolism, remember what that is defined as. What is metabolism? That's right. All of the chemical reactions that are occurring within an individual organism, however many cells it has. So each of your individual cells has thousands of chemical reactions occurring all the time. But however many an organism has altogether, considered altogether, that's metabolism. Well, this is part of metabolism. It's more than one reaction, though, and that's why it's called a pathway. You're used to the knowing what happens in any given chemical, single chemical reaction, right? In any given chemical reaction, there is a change that takes place. A change in which however many reactants get turned into however many products. That's what happens in any given chemical reaction, right? Well, a pathway is more than one chemical reaction. It's at least two. And this happens to show three, but the number isn't important as long as it's two or more. But it's not just the number that makes it a pathway. It's the arrangement. So in a biochemical pathway, whatever the products are of the first reaction then get turned into something else in the second reaction. In other words, the reactant of reaction one serves the product of reaction one serves as the reactant for reaction two, which gets turned into the second product, and now that is the reactant in reaction three, and so on for however many reactions there are. It's a chain of reactions, in other words. That's the relationship between the individual reactions. And so, however long it is, you start with some original reactant, and through however many changes, you end up with some final product. D, in this case. That's one. That's just the definition of a biochemical pathway. There's all kinds of biochemical pathways operating all the time in your body. But another important part of this slide is what you see on top of each arrow. Each arrow indicates a reaction, right? So you know that these are distinct reactions, just part of a pathway, simply by the fact that there's arrows. But remember how arrow notation works. You write the reactants on one side of the arrow and the products on the other side of the arrow. Enzymes are listed here above the arrow, and that's important because an enzyme is not a reactant. An enzyme is a substrate. I mean, is a catalyst, right? A catalyst is not necessary for a reaction to occur. It's not a reactant. It's not a product. And therefore, shouldn't be written on either side of the arrow because that's for reactants and products. It's written above to remind you of the fact that an enzyme, being a catalyst, helps the reaction out. So the reaction could proceed without that enzyme, but it's not going to go nearly as fast as it does with the help of the enzyme. Enzymes, or just more generally, catalysts, speed up chemical reactions, usually millions of times at least. And that's really important for biology because to remain alive, you have to have the chemical reactions that make up metabolism happen soon enough. They're not necessarily going to happen anytime soon without the help of an enzyme. So that's an important point. But it's also important to notice that each individual reaction has its own enzyme. This is not the same enzyme used three times. It's three different proteins, each acting as a specific enzyme for a specific reaction. Now, why it would be easier, less complex, if you had a master enzyme that works for all of your reactions, rather than having a different enzyme for each reaction type. What would be the problem with that?
Would it create the same product every time?
No, because if it were a master enzyme, kind of like a master key getting in every door, the product would depend on what the reactant is. So if it were reusable for every reaction, the reactions would still proceed the same way as they do with having their own enzymes. That's determined by whatever the reactant is. That's not the problem. The problem is that if you had a universal enzyme, then all of your possible chemical reactions would be occurring all the time, and you would never want that to happen. An important part of metabolism is that a cell is allowing only the appropriate reactions at any given moment to occur and disallowing others from occurring. This is another important point about enzymes in general. Not only do they speed up reactions, but without them, the reactions are so slow from the viewpoint of the organism that they effectively are not happening. So enzymes not only speed up reactions, they determine whether reactions really occur or not. And by having a specific enzyme for each individual type of reaction, that means each individual type of reaction can be controlled, can be either turned on or turned off. That's for each individual reaction, and therefore, since a biochemical pathway is a chain of individual reactions, that means pathways themselves can be controlled. We'll talk more about that in a different slide. Let's go to slide two, though, and talk a little bit more about energy, which is not an easy thing to define. A lot of textbooks define it, energy as the capacity to do work, which is partially true. Energy is not material, but it is a capacity to do work. That's one way of spending energy. You can also, energy can be transferred also as heat, which is distinct from doing work, or as light. But energy is not material. It allows things to happen, though. It forces things to happen. And there are many different forms of energy, like light energy, for instance, or heat is a form of energy, electrical energy, and so on. But there are really two big important categories of energy, despite the forms. And those are potential energy and kinetic energy, which you've probably heard before. I figured that wouldn't work since it was already open when I got here. So have you heard these terms, potential and kinetic? Potential energy is often defined as stored energy, meaning that it's energy that can be used, but at the moment is not being used. That's what potential as a word refers to, right? It has potential. It could be used. Whereas kinetic energy is energy in motion. That's what the word kinetic really refers to. It's the same, even though it's spelled different, it's the same root as in cinema, which means moving pictures. So kinetic energy is energy of motion. And Importantly, there can be interconversion between these two categories. That happens all the time, as in this example picture. The farther away from the surface of the Earth you are, the greater your gravitational potential energy. And you can spend kinetic energy in the form of walking up the stairs of this diving deck to increase your gravitational potential energy. So you're converting kinetic energy into potential energy by doing that. Right? You're more likely to fall, in a sense, the more you climb. If you're right on the surface, you're not as likely to fall. But then if you do accidentally or intentionally dive off, then the reverse is going to happen. Your potential your gravitational potential energy is going to be turned into kinetic energy as you move faster by falling through that gravitational gradient. So there's always an interconversion in what we call thermodynamic systems, which I'll define in a minute. There's always an interconversion between kinetic and potential energy. The most important potential energy in terms of this course, I mean, by important, I just mean the thing that we're going to talk about most, is chemical potential energy, which is stored in the molecular bonds, the chemical bonds of the various molecules cells use. So energy is in food because food is made up of molecules. Those molecules have chemical potential energy in them. Some of that energy gets used to do the various things in the cell that require energy. It's not a direct process, it's indirect, but we'll talk about the particulars of that. But I just mentioned, we're on slide 3 now, I just mentioned thermodynamic system. And I should define what that is. Thermodynamics is a branch of science dealing with energy transactions and heat. But anyway, when we talk about a system, which is sometimes we just shorten it to system, but really it's thermodynamic system, that can be just about anything you want it to be. Or it really can be anything you want it to be, as long as you define it. There is the universe, which is everything. And a thermodynamic system is some specific subset of that universe. So it could be like a insulated bottle, which a couple of you have. If you define it that way, it could be this room. It could be your body. It could be a chemical reaction. Just about anything. As long as you say what it is, then that by defining that, you not only define the system, which is whatever you say it is, but also the so-called surroundings. So you have the universe, which is everything, and if you define a thermodynamic system, now you have two subsets that don't overlap. You have the system itself and everything else in the universe, which is the surroundings. Okay? There are more than three, but I'm going to define three kinds of thermodynamic systems. I'm not talking about examples, I'm talking about categories. There are open systems, closed, and isolated. An open thermodynamic system, or just open system, more simply, is any system that can exchange both energy and matter with the surroundings. A closed system can exchange energy with the surroundings, but not matter. And an isolated system can't exchange either matter or energy with the surroundings. And by the way, there's no such thing as a truly isolated system. It's more of a mental concept that's important for defining things and whatnot. There can be approximations. I mean, when you build a Dewar flask or a thermos bottle, which is designed in such a way to minimize energy exchange, it's sealed off, so it is closed. There's no matter that gets in or out. But even though it's designed to minimize the exchange of energy with the environment, which is why it can keep things at either hot or cold, there's no such thing as a perfect one. Right? You come back a year later, it's not going to still be cold or hot. So there's really no real isolated system. Those are the three major categories I want you to know, though. And also, speaking of thermodynamics, there are laws that have been formulated. Four laws of thermodynamics, but we're going to pay attention only in this course, because of their applicability to biology, to only two of them. Now, the ones we're going to pay attention to in this course are the first law and the second law, but they're really the two middle of the four laws. They made the first, second, and third law, and then started realizing, well, actually, we need something more basic than the first law. And since they were already named first, second, and third, and they didn't want to confuse the hell out of everyone, they just made it the zeroth law. So those are the four. The zeroth, the first, the second, and the third. Anyway, don't worry about the zeroth or the fourth. I mean, the third, we're going to talk about just the first and the second law. And the first law of thermodynamics is often stated as the law of conservation of energy, which says that the total amount of energy in the universe is constant. Energy can't be created, it can't be destroyed. Energy in the universe, that is. Although it can't be created or destroyed, though, importantly, it can be transformed and transferred. Transformation of energy refers to changing it into a different form. Like when radiant energy, the energy of sunlight, gets captured and put into chemical energy form of the molecules that are made by photosynthetic organisms like plants, for instance. Or the burning of gasoline gets put into energy of motion, and so on. There's all kinds of transformations that are always happening inside of biology and outside of biology, just involving living things and non-living things. Transferring energy refers to moving it from one object to another. One body to another, but body here just means object, doesn't mean a living thing necessarily. You know, like the breaking of a rack of billiard balls. You transfer that energy of motion from the cue ball to the balls that are in the rack. And now all of a sudden they're moving. That's transferring energy. So that's what the first law says. And you can see an energy transformation taking place here, or it's going to take place. This predator is taking in food, which contains chemical energy, and then that chemical energy is going to be used to do a lot of different things in the predator, including, in the second picture, allowing him to run. But that second picture is really listed for the second law of thermodynamics, which has been stated different ways, but an important part of the second law of thermodynamics is the notion of entropy. Have you studied entropy? Have you been introduced to entropy in any other courses? Well, Entropy is more or less disorder. And what the second law says is that the entropy of the entire universe can only increase. It can't get more ordered. It can't get more ordered. It can only get more disordered. In a sense, the universe is continuously unwinding, becoming more random. Now, when you think back to the very first lecture of the term, when we had that slide in which we introduced seven major things that living things share, one of those was a high degree of order. You might remember. Living things are not the only highly ordered things, but living things they all exhibit a high degree of order. This is not a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. There are no violations. It's the law. What I mean to say is that a system, a thermodynamic system, some subset of the universe, can become more highly ordered, which means its entropy would decrease. Get that in your mind. Entropy is disorder. So by becoming more ordered, you're reducing the disorder. It's kind of like a double negative. So a decrease in entropy means an increase in order, because entropy itself is disorder. Anyway, a subset of the universe, a thermodynamic system, can become more highly ordered, but only if the surroundings become more disordered. And not only that, the increase in entropy of the surroundings, the amount by which it becomes more disordered, is even greater than the amount of disorder that's decreased in the system itself. So that the combination of the two, in other words, the entropy of the entire universe, still increases. All right? So living things are always increasing the order. If you define each individual as a thermodynamic system, which is fine to do, each system is it's decreasing its entropy, but only because the rest of the universe is becoming even more disordered than the individual is becoming ordered. So entropy of the universe is always increasing. But another important part of this second law is that there is no such thing as a perfectly efficient thermodynamic process. Meaning, however much energy is available in a given system, like in a chemical reaction, for instance, it's never the case that all of that energy can be used to perform work. It's always the case that some of the energy in an energy transaction gets lost as heat. What I mean by lost as heat, it means that it's unavailable to perform work for you. We'll be talking about useful energy, which is energy that can be put to useful work in the cell. But the law states, this is not just about biology, this is any system. Heat is energy transfer that does not involve work, and therefore, in a sense, is not useful. It's not to say that heat generation itself isn't useful, it's just that it's not performing work as defined in physics. Work is movement of things. Movement of things involves work. For instance, we are endothermic homeotherms, which means the homeotherms part of that phrase means we maintain pretty narrow limits of temperature despite what's happening around us, right? When it's cold or hot, we maintain body temperature or die. Not all animals do that, but we do. And the endothermic part of that means that the source of our heat, largely for our maintenance of our body temperature, is our metabolism. Which is why we can be warm even though it's cold out, if it ever gets cold again. So, in that sense, heat, which is kind of waste energy, as in a sense, is valuable still. It's just not performing work in the thermodynamic sense. Okay, so that's why you have heat coming off of this. There's so much energy that's required to propel this cat. Only some of the energy that was available in chemical form from the food that he ate can be used to propel him. Much of it is lost as heat because of the required inefficiency. That's what I meant about saying that there's no such thing as a 100% efficient process, which is why perpetual motion machines are impossible, regardless of how long people try to make them. It's not going to be possible. Okay, let's go to slide 4 and talk about free energy, which has the symbol G. Now, that doesn't seem to make sense for free energy, but it actually stands for Gibbs free energy. So it's an eponym, something named after usually a dead person. We don't usually bother saying Gibbs free energy, even though that's what the G stands for. We just say free energy. But the free energy in a thermodynamic system is the potential energy, the energy that's available to do some work. And what I just was saying about the second law of thermodynamics is that you can never actually use all of that free energy to do work, because some of it's going to have to be wasted. All right. But anyway, that's what G is. It is potential energy. G by itself is the symbol that refers to the amount of potential energy, the amount of free energy at the moment. All right. Well, in this slide, we see three examples in cartoon form of thermodynamic systems, before and after. So notice the top row is the system before, and then the same system after. So I just told you that G by itself, just as a letter, refers to free energy at the moment. So there's a G value before, and then there's a G value after. And what we actually care more about than G is delta G, the change in the G value. Okay, so you have to have before and after, you have to have two values to compute a delta G. The change in free energy is what delta G is. And notice that in all three of these system examples, guy on the diving platform, a gradient, a concentration gradient in the second, and a molecule in the third. Those are the three systems. Notice that when they change to their final form on the bottom, each of those involves a numerical reduction in the instantaneous value of G. In other words, G initial is higher than G final. And keep in mind how you compute delta G, the same way you compute change in mass of potatoes that you soaked, right? It's G final minus G initial. Therefore, if you start with an initial value that's higher than the final value, mathematically that means you're going to have a smaller number minus a larger number, which is always going to be a negative number, right? Well, that's what is happening in each of these examples. Each of these systems is undergoing a change in free energy that is negative. There's a negative delta G for all three of these. The sign of delta G is really even more important than the numerical value. Because if delta G is negative, that tells you that that process, whatever it is, the actual falling off of the diving, the diffusion that's happening here, or the hydrolysis of this large molecule into smaller ones, that process, if the delta G is negative, is spontaneous. Really important word in energy transactions. Spontaneous means that that process can happen on its own. There is no requirement for any outside energy being delivered to cause that to happen. It happens simply because systems want, in a sense, to go to the lowest G level possible. So lower G values, not delta G, lower G values, which is, you know, the instantaneous value, lower G values, though, make a system more stable. So high G values equate in your mind with instability. Low G values equate with stability. And that's why processes happen, basically. It's because they want to achieve a more stable state in terms of energy, of free energy. They want to become well, there's all kinds of examples. All three of these examples is a more stable state on the after. Right? He's falling down his gravitational gradient. That's becoming more stable. The concentration gradient, that's hard to keep arranged like that, right? Where they're all stockpiled in one place. They want to spread out. And so that's what drives diffusion, the gradient itself. And a large complex molecule is not as disordered as little pieces that you break it into. Because even though this thing can swivel around, it doesn't have as many degrees of freedom as the individual pieces do, because once they're broken apart, they all can go in their own orientations. So this collection of products, has a less disorder than this does. This is more highly ordered. Notice the big chunk is. So in all three of these examples, G is decreasing, and therefore delta G is negative, and that makes these three processes spontaneous. If you have a positive delta G, which you would have if you tried to make these things happen in the reverse, then that is non-spontaneous. And a non-spontaneous process is never going to happen on its own. It's impossible. Doesn't mean that it can't happen. It just can't happen on its own. You have to force non-spontaneous processes to work, like active transport, for instance, does. Right? It would be moving this middle example the opposite direction. It takes energy from outside the system to do that. Now, I've used the word spontaneous and non-spontaneous, a pair of words, antonyms, right? They're opposites of each other, spontaneous, non-spontaneous. There's really three pairs of antonyms that I want you to have straight in your mind that kind of correspond to each other. But first, let me tell you about metabolism. Metabolism, as we've already said, is all of the chemical reactions that are occurring in an individual organism. But That's the whole set of chemical reactions. There's two subsets that you can divide it into, non-overlapping. And those two subsets together make up the entire set, metabolism. The two subsets are catabolism and anabolism. Cat means down, and means up. Catabolism is the part of metabolism that includes the reactions that break things down into smaller pieces. Whereas anabolism is just the opposite. It's the part of metabolism that builds larger things out of smaller. So the third example system here is a catabolic reaction, because you're starting with something bigger and you're breaking it into smaller pieces. That's catabolism. The reaction is catabolic. All right, so any given pathway or reaction is either catabolism or anabolism. There's no third category, and those don't overlap. So you can't be both anabolic and catabolic. All right, so spontaneous reactions, catabolic reactions correspond to spontaneous reactions. The third pair of antonyms has to do with what's happening to the energy. Remember, energy can't be created or destroyed. It can be transferred, so it has to be going somewhere. And therefore, we can define two possibilities, which are endergonic and exergonic, exact opposites of each other. The ergon part of this means energy. Endo means in, exo means out. So endergonic literally means energy is going in, is taken in. Exergonic literally means energy is released. All right, so now those are the six overall words, but three pairs of antonyms. Endergonic, exergonic. Those words, one of those two words would be used if what you're trying to describe is what is happening to the energy, because that's what they mean. All right. Spontaneous, non-spontaneous, you would use one of those two words if what you're trying to describe is whether or not that process can happen on its own. And catabolic, anabolic, you would use one of those words if what you are trying to describe is whether you are making big things out of small or small things out of big. But they correspond to each other. Exergonic reactions correspond to catabolic reactions. So not only does a catabolic reaction produce smaller things out of big, but in that process, energy is released, some of which can be put to use by the cell. Some, not all, right? You're always going to have some wasted as heat. But this is how you get energy out of molecules that start out as food. Remember, we don't take food into our bodies. We digest it while it's in our digestive tract. Then we take in molecules, put those into cells, and then break them down further, releasing energy, some of which can be captured to store in temporary form as ATP molecules, which then can be broken apart to re-release the energy to drive processes in the cell. So, catabolic and exergonic correspond to each other. Anabolic and endergonic correspond to each other. Exergonic reactions correspond to which of the spontaneity words? Right. Exergonic reactions are spontaneous because they have the energy required for it to happen already. And by happening, there is a reduction in G, right? That negative delta G means energy, free energy has been decreased, but you know that energy can't be destroyed, right? It has to go somewhere. So it's released by the system. That's why we came up with the name exergonic. It's released. It comes out of the system. Okay? So those are the three words that all correspond to each other. Exergonic, catabolic, and spontaneous. The other three words all correspond to each other, but in the opposite direction. Non-spontaneous, endergonic, and anabolic. Now think about your own bodies. That those molecules that come in as food originally, really small molecules, they have to be in order to get them into your cells, right? But then you use those as building blocks to build all your big molecules that we've been talking about in the macromolecules chapter, like all of your proteins. Those proteins were not in the food. Those proteins, you know, it's like taking a Lego model, a huge Lego model, breaking it down into individual bricks, taking those into your body, and then building something totally different out of the same bricks. You build your own proteins out of the amino acids that you got from the proteins in the food, but you're building them a totally different way under the instructions originally in your genes. But anyway, you're building big things up. That's anabolism. And that, therefore, requires energy. Well, you're doing this all the time, but to fuel that, to power that, I mean, you use energy that's released from catabolic reactions when you burn your fuels that came in as food. So you break down certain molecules to release energy so that you can then have the energy to power the building of bigger molecules by anabolism. All right, you have all six of the definitions in mind? Are any questions about any of them? Okay, let's go to five. This is a graph of, it's two graphs, obviously, but it's each of them is labeled the same way. You have time, basically, on the x-axis. It's progress of the reaction, but that means before and after, so it's time. But notice the y-axis. It's free energy, which is G, right? Every individual point, every y-value is a G, not delta G. Delta G requires two different G values to compute. So the delta G is the difference between these two bars. The two different values of G have a difference, and that's the delta G. Well, in the first one, the red one, notice the reaction. And here in a chemical reaction, remember, is a thermodynamic system. But in a chemical reaction, you start with reactants, you end up with products, as for any reaction. But in this case, you have a G value associated with the reactants that's higher than the G of the products. So by undergoing the reaction, delta G becomes negative. Right? That, by definition, is an exergonic reaction. Energy is released by the reaction, in this, which is the system. It comes out. But keep in mind, negative delta G also corresponds to spontaneous. So that means this thing can happen on its own. A very important thing about spontaneity, though, is that it only says it can happen. It says that it's possible. It doesn't at all tell you whether it's going to happen, just that it's possible. And it doesn't at all tell you how quickly it will happen if it does happen. All right? And this is what I was mentioning earlier This is part of what I was mentioning earlier when I said that without the help of an enzyme, a reaction could happen. Right? It could be spontaneous, but it could be so slow that it would never happen in your lifetime, and therefore it's effectively not happening unless the enzyme is activated. All right. Okay. But anyway, that's an exergonic reaction. Endergonic is exactly the opposite. So the products have a G value associated with them that is higher than the reactants do. You're going up in G, therefore it's a positive delta G. That's an endergonic reaction, and it corresponds to non-spontaneous. But in terms of metabolism, an endergonic reaction would be anabolic. It's expensive to build those big molecules, so you have to put the energy in, and you get the energy by coupling those endergonic reactions that are required with exergonic reactions that supply the energy, because by breaking those fuels down, you're releasing energy, and some of that energy is captured and put to use powering the endergonic anabolic reactions that are non-spontaneous by themselves. All right. Six. Well, the cartoon here is of a hydroelectric system isolated on the top. Actually, that's a misnomer. The book uses the word isolated. It really should be closed because this thing is not... This is exchanging energy, right? It has a light that is shining to the surroundings, so that's not really isolated. It's closed. But anyway, it's not exchanging materials. That's why it's closed. The water in it is constant. But notice that at first, the water level on the left is high and low on the right, and the only way it can go down its gravitational gradient is to go through this little tube that turns a turbine that creates electricity just like a dam does, and that's why the light is lit up at first. But notice that since this is a closed system, no new water is coming in, and therefore this thing is going to come to thermodynamic equilibrium, namely when the gradient goes to zero, right? When there's no more difference in the water level, that's a gravitational gradient of zero, just like a concentration gradient of zero means that there is no more tendency for net diffusion. There's no more tendency for water to fall anymore. The level has come to be equal on both sides, and therefore no more turning of the turbine. The light goes out. Well, in an open hydroelectric system, you're continuously adding water. That maintains this gradient. Well, if you add enough water so that it matches the amount that's lost from the first to the second tank. If you're always putting in the same amount of water that's going downhill, then that gradient will be there forever, right? And therefore, the light will stay up, stay lit. These things are analogous to individuals, to organisms, I mean. Any living organism is an open thermodynamic system. No organism can be a closed system. And that's simply by definition of systems, as I told you already. When we talked about surface area to volume ratio, I mentioned that a living organism has to continuously exchange materials and energy with the surroundings. Well, that by definition is an open system, not a closed system, right? But this coming to equilibrium and the light going out, that's what would happen with a cell and therefore an organism. If they're never really coming to equilibrium. Equilibrium equals death in that respect. But even though this is an open hydroelectric system and is better at representing an organism than a closed one is, an even better representation is on the bottom, a multi-step open system, which is several tanks, and each pair of tanks features its own gradient, which is just a little piece of the overall gradient. So you have the same change in water levels in these two bottom pictures. It's just that the second one is the overall change is broken into little steps along the way. And this really represents us better as or any organism, not humans, not just humans, because the energy that we get out of our fuel, which comes from our food, is not released all at once. That would be an uncontrollable and lethal release of energy. It would kill the cells. Instead, we release it a little bit at a time, which is why we don't burn our fuels in one reaction, which you can do chemically, right? But that is called an explosion. That's what happens in the cylinder of an internal combustion engine. You get it all at once, a hell of a release. Instead, we have not just one reaction, but a pathway, or actually several pathways. And along the way, each individual constituent reaction in the pathway can release just a little bit of that energy in manageable amounts. That's why it's a better thing on the bottom. Okay. Now, slide 7. What are we looking at here? It's a very famous molecule.
ATP.
Right, that's ATP, which is adenosine triphosphate. Now, that's what it stands for, but adenosine is itself a molecule. I'll talk about that in a second. First, though, let me ask you to remind us of even before that, what is ATP an example of? What kind of molecule? Right, it is a nucleotide. Remember that any nucleotide has three components. A pentose sugar, which ribose is, connected simultaneously to two things. A nitrogenous base, which in this case is adenine, and a phosphate. At least one phosphate. In this case, it's three. But that qualifies this thing as a nucleotide. And so this could be used as a building block that could be incorporated into an RNA molecule because it's ribose as the sugar. Right, that's one use of ATP. You have three other similar ones that use different nitrogenous bases, right? Because you have four nitrogenous bases for RNA. If you're building an RNA molecule, you would use a bunch of nucleotides and hook them together. But ATP also has a completely different and very important job, which is to carry energy around, to temporarily store energy. They're a little bit like little batteries. You charge them up, and then you use them to discharge them for your purposes. And ATP is often in textbooks described as the energy currency of the cell. Have you heard this definition? It's a lot of textbooks will say that. That's a good analogy, currency. When you think about money, which is currency, money doesn't really do anything for you, right? But it's important. No one nowadays really works directly for the things that person needs. You don't work for your food, for your housing, for all the other things that you have in your life that you own, right? Your work is your effort, though, your energy. Instead, you work for currency, for money, which, once you have it, represents all of that energy that you spent, all of that effort. But the nice thing about that is that there's all kinds of different things you can spend that on. It's versatile. Right? So you can spend it on rent, on a car, whatever. Similarly with ATP. organisms don't directly use the energy that's released by breaking down their fuel molecules that came from food. Those are exergonic reactions. When you burn fuels in your cells, that releases energy. So that's exergonic. That's where the energy comes from. But we don't, our cells do not directly use that released energy from the fuel to drive the endergonic processes that have to happen in the cell. There's all kinds of endergonic reactions that are required that make up anabolism, right? You can't build your molecules up without the energy. But the point is here, we don't just burn the fuels and use that release of energy directly to drive those anabolic processes. Instead, we temporarily store that released energy, or some of it, because some will be lost as heat, in the form of ATP molecules. That's like charging the little batteries, which is useful because they're so versatile. Right? If you did directly use energy released from fuel burning to drive anabolic reactions, you would have to have specific reactions occurring for each specific anabolic reaction that you're trying to power. So instead, we don't do that. We have an energetic middleman, the energy currency, which is ATP, that all kinds of different fuel burnings can release energy to create ATP. And then that same ATP, many copies of it, can be used to power a hell of a wide range of different anabolic reactions. That's the energy currency analogy. But what makes it carry the energy is when it is in this form, ATP, adenosine triphosphate, because there's three phosphates. These additional phosphates, it only takes one to make this a nucleotide, by definition. But these additional phosphates store a lot more energy in this molecule. And so the money analogy, by the way, the energy currency, it's really better to think of it as a debit card than cash. Because in a debit card, the value changes, right? You have a certain balance. You can make a deposit into a debit account, and that gives you more purchasing power. If your balance gets low, you might still be able to spend a little bit, but it gets eventually time to make another deposit. And so that's continuously happening with this and related molecules. ATP is one form. It's like a high balance debit card that you've made a deposit to recently and haven't used. If you take one of these phosphates off, you're spending some of that energy. And that turns ATP into ADP, an inorganic phosphate. Because when you cleave the phosphate off, this terminal phosphate, it's a phosphate by itself now. And what's left is ADP, adenosine diphosphate. That's still valuable, but it's like a debit card with a lower balance. All right? If you take that second one off of ADP, you turn it into adenosine monophosphate, which is like when you're getting the message from the bank that you got a very low balance now. And so that's a signal to the cell. You need to turn some of this AMP back into ATP by doing the reverse of using the ATP. This is why the battery analogy is good. Right, you use the batteries, spending the energy, but they're reusable, rechargeable batteries, so you can put energy into them to get them back to ATP form. Now, when I first talked about nucleotides, which I was discussing then, not for the purpose of energy carrying, but as components of nucleic acids, But anyway, I told you at the time that if you had just these two components, a nitrogenous base and the pentose sugar, nothing else, then those two combined would be considered a nucleoside. So in other words, to make a nucleotide, you have to add at least one phosphate to a nucleoside. And nucleotide as a word doesn't really tell you anything about the phosphates, because AMP is a nucleotide, ADP is a nucleotide, ATP is. You can't tell from the word nucleotide how many phosphates there are. So it's not as descriptive as calling this thing either a nucleoside monophosphate, a nucleoside diphosphate, or a nucleoside triphosphate. ATP is a nucleoside triphosphate. Still a nucleotide, but it's more descriptive to say nucleoside triphosphate. All right? If you have a nucleoside by itself, though, it gets a name based on what particular nitrogenous base you have. So in this particular combination of ribose and adenine, that nucleoside is called adenosine. So the adenosine part of ATP's name is the name for the nucleoside. And triphosphate refers to the fact that there are three phosphates hooked to it. Okay, let's go on to 8. This shows you the using of ATP. By using, I mean the spending of some of its energy. What kind of reaction is this that we're looking at? This is a hydrolysis reaction. To use ATP means to hydrolyze it. That's why water is required. And you're already familiar with the fact that hydrolysis is going to split it into two pieces. But when you split an ATP molecule, you're really splitting the bond between the two phosphates at the end. And that is going to create two products. You'd expect it to create two products, right? Because your hydrolysis transforms a big thing into two smaller things. One of these is P sub I listed here now. That's an inorganic phosphate. But that's the symbol for an inorganic phosphate. The I means inorganic. Why is it inorganic?
It's more connected to the sugar.
That's right. All phosphate groups are the same, but this one is no longer connected to any carbon skeleton, which is what makes it organic, if it's part of the organic molecule. It's, remember, that a phosphate group is just phosphorus atom and four oxygen atoms. And that's an important thing to remember, by the way. This P does not mean phosphorus. When you see P without a circle around it, that's a phosphorus atom. When you see P with a circle around it, that's just shorthand for the phosphate group. And a phosphate group with an I subscript is an inorganic phosphate. So it's on its own. It's no longer part of an organic molecule. It just becomes part of the phosphate pool, and the very next moment it might be stuck onto an ADP to make it ATP. But the other chunk is ADP itself, which still has usable energy in it, just not as much as ATP did. And that's why energy is shown here as an output of this reaction. So the hydrolysis of ATP is exergonic, right? It releases energy. But it doesn't create any energy. The reason it releases energy is because you first had to store that energy in the ATP molecule by building it to begin with, which is not shown here. The building of it, though, is exactly the reverse of this. And you already realize that hydrolysis has an exact reverse to it, right? What kind of reaction is the reverse?
Dehydration.
If you run this backwards, so against the arrow here, you would be adding an inorganic phosphate to an ADP molecule to create an ATP molecule. That's charging the battery, and that's what we use the energy that's released by burning our fuels directly for. Instead of directly powering the endergonic reactions we require, we directly power the the dehydration of reaction that creates ATP out of ADP and inorganic phosphate. And that releases water, the reverse, right? Okay. So it's both the forward and the reverse direction are always happening trillions of times a second in your body because there are so many of these. All right? You should think of the ATP, as the adenosine nucleotides, meaning AMP, ADP, and ATP all combined. You have a pool of them, and at any given moment, there's a certain fraction of them are in the form of ATP, a certain fraction ADP, and a certain fraction AMP. But just, you know, ATP is energy storage, but not very long term, because just pretty much as soon as you build it, you spend it somewhere. And then you rebuild it again, so it's continuously going back and forth, mostly between ATP and ADP form. There are situations in which you spend the ADP to create AMP, but your body tries not to let that happen much, because when the AMP starts building up, that's a strong signal to your body that you are using more energy than you are actually creating from burning fuels. And therefore, you need to start burning more fuels so you can change those AMPs back into ATP. AMP is an emergency situation, in other words, when it's high levels. Okay. 9. Now, somewhere along the line today, I told you that I think it's when we were looking at the graphs that we have all kinds of endergonic reactions that have to happen, and those, of course, are non-spontaneous. They can't occur on their own because they require an input of energy, by definition. But nonetheless, they are absolutely required for the cell to remain alive. So we power those endergonic reactions with energy that's released by exergonic reactions, the burning of fuels. And we do that by coupling the two processes. We couple an endergonic reaction with an exergonic reaction in a way that usually involves ATP. And that is illustrated in 9. So in the top we have an endergonic reaction. And it doesn't matter what this example is, but let me just say that it's an endergonic reaction. You should recognize it as an endergonic reaction even if you didn't have the positive delta G, which by itself says endergonic. But you should know it's endergonic simply because you're bringing two things together to build a bigger thing, right? So it's anabolic, endergonic, non-spontaneous. In this case, though, glutamic acid, which is an amino acid, and ammonia get hooked together to make glutamine. The cell needs to do that. But it can't happen on its own. All right? On the second row, you see that if you have glutamic acid and ATP react, the phosphate that gets cleaved off of ATP in its hydrolysis gets stuck onto glutamic acid. Glutamic acid, in other words, gets phosphorylated by ATP. Phosphorylation simply refers to adding a phosphate onto something. All right? And often, phosphorylating something invests it with energy. So in other words, ATP here in the second row is being spent to form a high-energy version of glutamic acid. Now look at the third row. If you already have energized, phosphorylated glutamic acid, then it can easily react with ammonia to form glutamine. And the phosphate gets popped off, and it's once again inorganic phosphate. So this is a coupling of endergonic reaction with the exergonic hydrolysis of ATP to provide that phosphate and energy. And look at the balance sheet on the bottom. This first reaction, that's the endergonic one. You can tell that because the delta G is positive. Positive 3.4 kilocalories per mole in this case. The hydrolysis of ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate is the next one down. It's exergonic, right? Negative value, negative 7.3 kilocalories per mole. So notice that the hydrolysis of ATP provides more than enough energy to drive this endergonic reaction. To make the endergonic reaction happen, you have to supply at least 3.4 kilocalories per mole. ATP hydrolysis does that. Therefore, when you have them happening as a couple, when you couple the two processes, the overall delta G for that coupled combination process is negative. That's why it will happen. Yes, that individual reaction is non-spontaneous, but the couple, when it's happening as part of a coupled reaction, which is a bigger system now, that system is still exergonic because you have a negative delta G. Now, what if you had an endergonic process instead of this one, which has delta G of positive 3.4? What if it was a positive delta G of positive 7.3? In other words, exactly the energy that ATP hydrolysis spits off. What would happen? Would that be enough? Would ATP be enough to drive that? And why? They would add up to zero, right? Yes, there is. That's the answer I'm trying to get at. Why is exactly 7.3 that you get out of ATP not enough to cause a reaction that requires 7.3 to happen? Why is it not enough?
Is that the heat?
Yes. It's the second law of thermodynamics. You never get all of the useful energy to do the work for you. You're always, in any energy transaction, going to lose some as heat. So that's why the exergonic reaction has to be more exergonic than the endergonic one is. It has to not only be negative, but it has to be the magnitude, the numerical part has to be even bigger. The absolute value has to be bigger than the absolute value of the positive delta G process. And the heat that you lose is not negligible. Consider an internal combustion engine. You don't get anywhere close to 100% of the energy that's contained in gasoline propelling you down the road. I mean, for one thing, you hear the car coming down. It's making noise with the tires, especially knobby tires. That's a lot of friction that causes that sound. Well, that's some of the energy wasted right there. But even before you get to that point, the vast majority is lost in the engine itself, creating so much waste heat that you have to have a dedicated cooling system, or that engine will seize up very quickly. Most of the energy that you burn in gasoline just goes into heating the engine up, doing no work at all for you. And similarly, there's a big fraction of heat that's lost in all the energy transactions within organisms. All right, well, remind me that we'll start with 10.